Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. We recently reported that an oil and gas company operating in Wyoming was fined by the Federal Office of Natural Resource Revenue for not submitting production reports. Turns out the company has a history of poor behavior in the state, fiscally and environmentally. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff reports that although Pure Petroleum's gross neglect of its responsibilities is somewhat of an exception, it does point to big flaws in the oil and gas industry's reclamation system.
The Office of Natural Resources Revenue fined Pure Petroleum for not submitting production reports starting in 2006. The Bureau of Land Management started having issues with the company around 2008. The State Oil and Gas Conservation Commission filed a complaint in 2010. Here's Tom Kropach of the Oil and Gas Commission listing just some of the state's complaints.
Failure to report the spill, failure to operate two pits in a workmanlike manner. They had unpaid conservation taxes. They weren't posting their idle well bond that was past due. They hadn't performed MITs or the mechanical integrity tests.
Today, it is 2013, and Pure has not addressed any of the issues with any of the agencies. It did, however, leave behind abandoned wells, some of them messy, for the state to deal with.
To date, with Pure Petroleum, we've spent $645,743 on the cleanup work.
For just these sorts of instances, oil and gas operators have to put up bonds in case they bail on their responsibility to clean up once they finish producing. But these bonds are just a fraction of what it actually costs to plug a well. For example, the BLM will take just a $25,000 state blanket bond to cover all of the wells an operator has in the state, which could be hundreds. Or it will take just a slightly larger national blanket bond, which would cover thousands of wells. The Oil and Gas Commission asks for a $75,000 blanket bond.
We've spent more money on the cleanup so far to date than what they had posted in bonds. The remainder of that money comes out of the Orphan Well Fund, which is paid from conservation taxes that the operators pay.
Pure, by the way, owes conservation taxes. So, to summarize, Pure had about $120,000 bonded to the state and feds combined. So far, the state alone has spent nearly six times that on cleanup. And Pure has 101 wells on the state's orphan list, almost all of them on private land, which means the state will spend a lot more. So, what happened?
I think in Wyoming, the proverbial chickens have come home to roost on the regular boom and bust we see in the oil and gas development.
That's the Powder River Basin Resource Council's Jill Morrison, who has been following Pure's demise and similar problems in the industry for years.
What I have observed as I have been watching this process unfold over the last 5 to 10 years is a lot of coddling and hand-holding by the state of these companies that are clearly incapable of managing a decent business where they're going to be responsible. And the state keeps giving them another chance and another chance and another chance.
Indeed, neither the state nor the BLM has a clear policy on how patient to be with bad operators and approaches them on a case-by-case basis. The BLM Buffalo Office Supervisory Petroleum Engineer, Matthew Warren, worked with Pure.
There's not really any policy on that, and the way the regulations are written, I don't know necessarily how to be stricter.
Then there's the bonding system itself. University of Wyoming's department head of the Agriculture and Applied Economics Department, Roger Coppell, studied this issue. Simply put, he says bonds are too low to cover reclamation if an operator doesn't do the work. He estimates that it costs about $30,000 to reclaim one well, while the bond per well in the state is usually closer to $6,000.
Why have a bond? Well, the bond is there. The stated reason is because it gives them an incentive to clean things up. Well, if it's not big enough, it's not going to give them the incentive.
Coppell says in theory, the bonds were supposed to be big enough to cover actual costs. That's how it works in coal mining, for example. The BLM and Wyoming's Oil and Gas Commission can ask for additional bonds after production starts if they suspect they might need them. The state did ask, but Pure did not put up those bonds. The BLM never got around to asking. Further, the bonds don't grow over time. The BLM does not put them into an interest accruing account. The state does, but the interest does not go towards reclamation. Coppell points out that most companies do follow through and clean up. Their incentive, however, is not the bonds.
The companies tend to, especially the majors, tend to want to, for reputation, for no other reason, want to because they're usually in here for the long run, and they want to make sure they have a good reputation.
But Pure certainly is not alone. The state has 1,200 wells on its orphan list, a large percentage of them from the coal bed methane boom. The BLM has many idle wells, too, but it's not clear how many they will have to clean up. The commission has promised to speed up its orphan well cleanup program next spring. But in 2011 and 2012 combined, it only got to 35 wells.
When it comes to reclamation, we don't think much about it during the boom. But then all of a sudden, when you know the rigs have left and the employment is gone, then we start looking at what we have and wondering why we didn't spend more time figuring out how to solve that before it became a problem.
It's not just the physical remains either. Pure Petroleum owes over $500,000 in severance taxes, interest, and penalties to the state. That's not even counting what it owes to the feds. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Wyoming has been producing oil for more than 100 years, which means the state has a lot of mature oil fields, fields that stopped producing a long time ago. Since its founding in 2004, the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute has been working to get those fields back into production using innovative techniques for recovering the oil. Now, the institute has some new equipment that it hopes will improve its existing capabilities and encourage more investment in the approach. Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports.
A typical oil well only flows for a couple of years, maybe a decade. After it stops flowing naturally, companies often inject water to increase the reservoir pressure and get more oil out. But even with that, only 20 to 30% is recovered. David Moorbacher says that's where his institute's techniques come into play.
The oil is trapped in the rocks, a lot like oil and grease gets trapped in your clothes. So these technologies are like detergent.
The detergent is typically either carbon dioxide or chemicals or both. Moorbacher says using those, companies can recover at least another 10% of the oil, roughly equivalent to the amount of oil produced in each of the previous stages. That adds up to quite a bit of crude.
Wyoming produced close to 120 million barrels of oil a year in the early 1980s. Currently, we're producing about half that amount, 60 million barrels of oil. 12% of that production comes from enhanced oil recovery.
But the enhanced oil recovery process isn't as simple as just going out and pumping a bunch of carbon dioxide down a well. Every reservoir is different, and figuring out how to get the oil out of any particular one requires some experimentation. Moorbacher says the Institute's new facilities at the University of Wyoming's Energy Innovation Center will help with that. In addition to a shiny new workspace, the lab has over $1 million of new, highly specialized equipment.
We've added machines that help us analyze oil, water, and rock, and determine how effective some of our advanced technology might be in the field.
Sheena Shi manages the lab, and she's eager to show off her new toys, starting with a machine called the Slim Tube.
Those are 60 feet of coil. Inside it's glass beads, and we put oil in it, added the pressure and the temperature to simulate the reservoir.
Then they add carbon dioxide until the oil starts flowing. She says knowing exactly how much gas they need to pump into the reservoir saves companies a lot of time and money. That's not the only reason to do testing in the lab, though. She says injecting the wrong chemicals or fluids down a well can be ineffective at best and ruinous at worst. For example, injecting water into a clay-rich formation can close the pores in the rock, effectively sealing off the oil.
That's called formation damage. So this type of tests, you can test in the laboratory.
The Institute had the capacity to do those tests before, but she says the new equipment is much more precise.
The older ones we had, you know, it's just we made ourselves before, and so not as accurate. And without those, it's going to be very money-consuming, time-consuming.
Most small oil companies, like many of those operating in Wyoming, wouldn't have access to the equipment, homemade or otherwise, without the Institute's lab. Moorbacher, the director, says that makes it all the more important as industry shifts to more complex techniques for recovering oil.
With the number of mature fields in Wyoming, you ask what the potential impact could be. And I'll go back to real round numbers, but 1 to 2 billion barrels of incremental oil, which is a lot of oil considering Wyoming's only produced 8 billion in the history of the oil business in the state.
In other words, enhanced oil recovery is only getting started. And here in Wyoming, the Institute is hoping to be at the center of it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
When we come back, we'll hear about a program to help scientists communicate better with non-scientists. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Science can be fascinating even to non-scientists, but when experts use a lot of industry jargon to explain their research, it can be hard to understand. Now that funding for research is harder to come by, scientists need to do more to win over the public's hearts and minds to back their work. The National Science Foundation will be hosting a workshop at the University of Wyoming to help scientists, engineers, and other academics communicate with the rest of us about their research. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
Geneticist Ann Sylvester is working in her greenhouse, examining stalks of corn in every stage of growth. The room is built to simulate a balmy Iowa cornfield. Fans blow sprinkles of water into the air, sun lamps beam over the stalks, and the roof can open up to allow carbon dioxide out and oxygen in.
So we're studying cell division and expansion in the shoot apical meristem and in the forming leaf primordia that emerge.
That's maize geneticist lingo that Sylvester uses to talk with her peers about her research. She's basically studying specific traits in corn plants to understand how they conserve water. Her research could ultimately lead to growing corn that's more water efficient, which could be especially interesting for ag producers if they can understand the way it's presented. Sylvester says scientific jargon has been developed in individual fields to be the most accurate way to explain certain concepts, but not necessarily the best way to talk to people outside the loop.
What we really need is to understand when our language is not really appropriate for the experience of the people that we're speaking with. We tend to work in a whirlwind of activity and forget about the sharing part outside of our scientific world.
Oh, it is an enormous problem, yes.
That's Scott Miller, an ecologist who studies how watersheds and aquifers in Wyoming work. He says there's been a communication gap between scientists and the public since the days of Galileo.
And there's always been tension within the scientific community whether scientists should stick to science and then hand that science off to others to interpret, or whether it was the job of the scientist to frame it in such a way that it was digestible.
Fewer scientists have the option of staying in that lingo bubble these days. Universities rely on grants from the National Science Foundation to fund their research, and that money comes from taxpayers. Sequestration cut this year's NSF budget by about $356 million, and grants are growing increasingly competitive. The NSF is also demanding that scientists include public outreach and education plans in their grant proposals.
And we should be able, as scientists, to show the public why what we're doing matters, because it's taxpayer money. And so there's an obligation on behalf of the scientists to be able to share that information back to the general public and explain it.
But the National Science Foundation knows these code-switching skills don't come naturally to everybody. So they're hosting a workshop on the UW campus this September called Becoming the Messenger. NSF spokeswoman Susan Mason says it's meant to help scientists, engineers, and mathematicians talk about their work in ways that are basic but socially relevant and interesting to the public. It's not unlike marketing.
We will cover how to create a message and how to distill that message. We will give them tips and techniques, giving them really some basics on how to frame all of their communication.
The future of science funding is contingent on public support. Many scientists hope that if they communicate their findings better, citizens and lawmakers might make more informed decisions. Also, the United States has slowed the number of its breakthroughs, especially in medicine, while China and India ramp up their efforts. And the future doesn't look bright. In 2011, the National Assessment of Education Progress showed that 1 in 3 American children are proficient in science in middle school, and only 1 in 5 when they graduate. Margie McGregor is a zoology PhD candidate who studies population control in coyotes and frequently visits middle and high school classrooms to talk about her job. She's passionate about talking with kids about her work.
It encourages more people to go into science. I think sometimes we lose students at, you know, at the younger ages because they're afraid of science. They don't understand it.
McGregor says if people can better understand scientific principles and why ongoing research matters, research might get more support. That way, more scientists can do better work and everybody wins. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
Students, researchers, and educators are welcome to attend the Becoming the Messenger workshop on September 11th and 12th. It's free of charge, but participants must register on the National Science Foundation website this coming week.
Shannon Smith is the new executive director of the Wyoming Humanities Council. Smith comes to the council after years working at a nonprofit focusing on advancing higher education through the use of information technology. She served on the board of a nonprofit that promotes the legacy of Western historian Marie Sandoz and sat on the Nebraska State Historical Society Board of Trustees. Smith has also taught at Ogallala Lakota College and as an author and historian. She wrote Give Me 80 Men, Women, and the Myth of the Fetterman Fight, which won the 2009 Nonfiction Book Award from the Wyoming State Historical Society. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff spoke to her about the role of the Humanities Council in Wyoming.
The Humanities Councils across the nation, there's one for each state and six territories, and we receive funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and that funding we then directly distribute to programming throughout the state. So a significant portion of what funding goes to the NEH comes directly to libraries in Lusk or museums in Casper.
And I understand the National Endowment for the Humanities has lost a lot of funding over the years and potentially will lose even more now. So how does that affect, you know, Wyoming's chapter?
And that's a great question. And we're all facing kind of the same issues. But what's terrific about the state of Wyoming is we also have alternate funding models. The state has been fantastic about providing funding for the last 4 years. And we're working with the state legislature to make sure that we can continue this fantastic relationship because those dollars also go directly to the people out in the communities. And the other leg of this financial model is that we do fundraising. And we have donors throughout the state. And we also have programming where we put the hat out and get a lot of support from folks. And part of the reason that I've been brought to the council is I have a strong background in fundraising and putting events on that also generate revenue. And so that's one of the things that I'm going to do is try to help break us from that dependency so that whatever funding we get from the NEH, whether it's cut 50%, which is the current budget, or whether we're able to salvage that and get more, what I'm trying to do is build us up some stability through the other branches of funding models and then use whatever we get from the NEH to go just directly to the communities.
And so you expect Wyoming's levels of funding to stay either level or increase, hopefully?
The goal for me is to make it so that we're very stable and hopefully increase so that we don't have to every year be worried about what happens in Washington, D.C. But we have just terrific support from throughout the state, and we're looking forward to working with, you know, our representatives to make sure that they understand that, you know, for every dollar that we get from the NEH, we're actually spreading that around for more than a dollar throughout the state.
Right. And you mentioned that one of your goals is obviously going to be fundraising.
Yes.
What about in terms of programming? What direction do you want to take?
And that's another exciting thing because in addition to grants that we issue to organizations throughout the state, we have a programming arm and we do really creative, clever things. One of the things for this coming year is called Journey Stories, and it's part of the Smithsonian Museum on Main Street program. And we're just finishing off with program called Key Ingredients that's been up in Powell right now, but is throughout the state, has been throughout the state. And what we do is we put together a program where we have specific locations that a museum will put up an exhibit and then add information from their own collections. And then we help them wrap programming and awareness around this program. And we're super excited about Journey Stories because it's telling the American story through travel or immigration. And Wyoming spends a lot of time on the road, and we're really excited to put together some really creative programming around that. So we do our own programming as well, which have a staff over here based not far off campus, and they're a terrific staff that really comes up with creative ways to spread the dollars around the state and put on some terrific programs.
In the past, the council has been very successful in opening up conversations about social issues in the state. Is that a priority for you?
Yes. Thank you for that question, because that's going to be a key priority for our organization. One of the things we're in the process of doing is our strategic planning for the next 5 years. And part of that, we've been given a charter from our volunteer board of directors that are representatives from throughout the state. And we had a meeting just in July, and that is the approach that we want to take. We want to show Wyoming can be a place where challenging conversations can be had civilly, and we can talk about social issues and topics that our state politicians ask us to touch. So sometimes it's hard for them to, in their positions, approach a controversial topic. Let us help by providing an open forum that is a safe place for multiple points of view. So that is going to be a key priority for us.
Are there specific conversations that you want to kind of encourage in the state?
We've been approached to talk about topics like, for instance, suicide, which is a major issue here in Wyoming. And so we're going to ask, around the state we're going to crowdsource and ask for topics. We've approached, gun control and gun legislation. There's topics related to spirituality and religion. And so we're going to ask for guidance in that regard, where a great conversation can be had.
All right. And how are you enjoying living in Wyoming? Have you lived here before?
I've not lived in Wyoming, but I'm a Western Nebraska girl and lived and grew up just not too far from the Wyoming border. And my historical research is in Wyoming. I wrote a lot about the Fetterman fight, which is based up at Fort Phil Kearny, south of Sheridan. And so I've written a lot about women of the West and women in Wyoming in particular. And my husband and I, we calculated we've put about 5,000 miles on in the state over the last 4 years. So we're really super into moving here and should be formally located within the next month.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the state. That was Shannon Smith, the new executive director of the Wyoming Humanities Council. Thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about a controversial proposal to raise the tax on beer in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Wyoming is not a big tax state, so it might not be much of a surprise to learn that Wyoming's beer taxes are the lowest in the country. Beer is taxed 2 cents a gallon, and according to the Tax Foundation, that amounts to a penny a six-pack for a consumer. There have been several efforts to raise the tax in recent years, but those proposals are typically dead on arrival. In a few weeks, the legislature's Joint Revenue Committee will revisit the issue, as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Here's the proposal. Senator Ray Peterson from Cowley wants the Joint Revenue Committee to support increasing the tax by 5 to 10 cents a gallon. The idea is to use the money from the tax increase to be spent on substance abuse programs in the state. That idea came from Fremont County, where officials say it's been difficult to find the money to pay for substance abuse treatment programs. Riverton Mayor Ron Warpness says they need help.
We have quite a serious alcohol problem in Fremont County. It's a serious problem across the state, but in Fremont County we seem to have our numbers up there in lights.
Other communities say they have similar concerns, and the Wyoming Association of Municipalities supports the tax increase. So do many in the substance abuse field, such as Dr. David Burney, who's the executive director of the Peak Wellness Center.
We need multiple streams of funding for our programs, and any opportunity to find some kind of stable funding source for what I consider to be essential treatment services and prevention services, I think would be a good thing to look at.
Burney says when you look at substance abuse in Wyoming, the biggest issue is alcohol abuse. And while he stresses that the legislature is supportive, he says they do not get enough state funding to properly address the issue. He says tax revenue could be a big help. Mayor Warpness says they targeted the beer tax because it's so low.
Beer is a substance that has 2 cents a gallon tax at this time, and that was put in place in 1935. And it's about time that they start paying their way.
As you might imagine, some bristle at that statement. Mike Mosier is the director of the State Liquor Association. Mosier says while the actual beer taxes are low, consumers do have to pay sales taxes on alcohol. And there are other liquor-related costs that those in the business pay. Mosier argues that the liquor industry does pay its fair share.
We bring in a lot more money off alcohol than a lot of other states. In fact, the last time I ran the numbers, we bring in about 3 times as much per capita off alcohol than Colorado does, even though their excise taxes are higher because we have a different system.
J.J. Moran is the owner of Four Winds Liquor and Lounge in Cheyenne. He says if the tax goes up, prices will go up higher than the tax.
Let's say it goes up to 7 cents a gallon. That tax then will probably be taken from the distributor, and it'll be 15, 20 cents, in which case we're going to have to raise our prices another 20, 25 cents on our markup. So it could have an effect on the case of beer that you would buy up to 45 to 50 cents.
Moran says it could mean the same kind of thing for a bottle of beer at the bar. He says beer drinkers are very price sensitive, and it would likely lead them to purchase cheaper beer and drinking at home, which could have an impact on the bar business in the state.
On a draft beer, you guys want to try? The Cowboy Gold?
This is the Alibi Bar in Laramie. It's both a package store and a bar that caters to both established members of the community and college students. Annie Hathaway isn't the least bit concerned about the tax.
I honestly don't think I would notice it or that it would affect me in any way. I don't think I consume enough beer for it to affect me. I think it could potentially be beneficial depending on how it's used.
When told that the money would help fund substance abuse programs, Stacey Sewell says she's in favor of the tax.
Yeah, I do have my research on the reservation where there's a lot of substance abuse. I think that's a great place for the money to go. But personally, I feel like I'm going to drink whether it costs me $3 or $3.50 to do it.
But there are others who doubt that enough money would be raised to address the substance abuse problem, and there is the point that with the tax increase, the price of beer at the bar will also increase more than the price of beer at the liquor store. This is Sarah Jacobs.
The establishments such as the Alibi will lose business because people are going to be paying so much for beer, they're going to stay home and drink it.
Which is what a bar owner like J.J. Moran is afraid of. He says there's a better way to address this than raising taxes.
Why should the group of people have to pay for the abusers? What I would suggest is maybe charging more for a DUI.
The legislature's revenue committee will take testimony on the proposal on September 13th. If the committee decides not to go forward with a bill, Senator Peterson says he will sponsor his own bill. But the measure faces a high bar. To get it introduced during the upcoming budget session, it will require a 2/3 vote in order for the bill to be considered. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Last week, we heard that the federal government might be selling Powder River Basin coal for less than it's worth. As reform advocate Tom Sanzillo described the sales,
there's no competition. The appraisals, by all accounts, including the Inspector General for DOI, are flawed. And there's been no audit in 30 years. So there's no accountability for the program, no oversight.
This week, Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce takes a look at the money the state might be missing out on as a result and what policymakers think should be done about it.
Wyoming makes bundles of money off of federal coal, usually more than $1 billion a year. About a fifth of that comes from the one-time sale of the right to mine the coal. In industry speak, that's called the coal lease bonus. Bill Mai is a state economist. He says Wyoming spends most of that money on schools.
There's been a lot of K-12 building going on the last 10 years, and the vast majority of that has been funded through those coal lease bonuses.
But some experts and advocacy groups say those projects aren't getting as much money as they could because the bidding isn't competitive. Most lease sales are initiated by the coal companies, who ask the government for certain tracts of coal, typically ones that are adjacent to their existing properties. That means that even though anyone can bid, it's normally just that company. Dan Neal with the Equality State Policy Center says that's troubling.
Which schools won't we be able to build because we sold the coal and we didn't get enough money for it?
Neal says beyond the lack of competition, the biggest issue he sees with the leasing program is that the federal government doesn't take into account export sales when determining the fair market value.
Coal in that world market is worth much more than we see Powder River Basin coal sold for domestically. And people of Wyoming definitely should share in that extra value of the coal.
Right now, exports make up less than 1% of coal sales from the Powder River Basin. But both industry and the state expect them to increase in the future. In light of that, and the fact that coal can only be sold once, Neal says he wants Wyoming's congressional delegation and state lawmakers to pressure the federal government for reforms to the system. But he may not find a very receptive audience. Senator Eli Bibow chairs the Appropriations Committee. He doesn't put much stock in the critics' arguments.
Well, I think that the process has worked for the last decade and two decades, and we've seen a lot of responsible development of our coal in the Powder River Basin. And so I think it's been working reasonably well. And then now to start changing it, particularly given the nature of the attack on coal, I would question why we would do any of that.
Beyond the issue of timing, Bibow dismisses the argument that the federal government is undervaluing mining rights.
Anybody can have their opinions and come up with an analysis as to what it is or what it isn't, and fair market value is pretty easy to determine. It's what a willing seller and a willing buyer on the day that the sale occurs are willing to A, offer, and B, accept.
The executive branch also thinks the program is working. Sean Reese advises the governor, and he says competition will increase on its own, without the government having to change the process.
As the mines grow into one another, you'll see more often, I believe, multiple companies bidding, and so that price may be even higher than what the BLM has set as the fair market value.
In other words, as coal mines continue to expand, there'll be real competition, and prices will go up. Reese says if the state were to see a problem with the pricing, it could weigh in at various stages in the sale. But for now, it has no plans to do that. And changes to the program probably won't happen without strong support from lawmakers in the nation's top coal-producing state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Author Ron Carlson's new novel, Return to Oak Pine, tells the story of four high school buddies reuniting in their fictional Wyoming hometown now that they've reached middle age. One character, Jimmy Brand, is dying of AIDS, and he and his friends get their high school garage band back together one last time. Carlson tells Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez that this is a quieter book in which the reader keeps company with these characters.
There is no cataclysmic car chase, but they had my interest, and as a writer, I judge all of my projects by the way that they draw me forward and that they retain my interest, and in a way, this isn't the right word either, but my affection.
So the story is set in a small rural western town. I know you're from Utah, but you've lived all over. Why did you set the story in Wyoming?
I'm deeply affected by the West, and of course, I grew up, and I'm of an age where I've known dozens of small towns, and many of them aren't the same places anymore. I mean, we lose these places. When I grew up in Utah, Park City was still an old, rough mining town, kind of vacant. So I wanted a town that was kind of freestanding, alone. And place is everything. I mean, nothing happens nowhere. So as soon as you believe the place, then all of a sudden it's available and something can happen.
I want to ask you what's significant about this place altogether. Some of the characters in the story have moved away. One went to Denver and one went to New York City for decades, and then they come back to Oak Pine. What is significant about Oak Pine as a place set apart from these other bigger cities and different regions?
Well, part of it is wherever you've spent your youth. I mean, I think we sort of never get over it. We go through those changes as a young person with certain friends in a certain place, and that's welded to us. And you can go off and have your big life anywhere you want to, but, I mean, the people we go through our first changes with are sort of our people. So that force of memory or nostalgia or affection was one of the driving forces in writing this book, I'd say.
I'd like to ask you to read a section from your book. There's a passage in which Mason Kirby returns from his law practice in Denver to his childhood home. His parents have died, and the renters who had been living there have abandoned it.
This was the house he grew up in, and though it looked like a ruined artifact, he knew it hadn't changed. The sunlight on the red bricks and the smell of the trees in the gardens in the early fall altered his breathing as he kicked through the high grass into the backyard. There was a metal clip and a cord on the clothesline, as well as a worn oval in the shaggy lawn. The Gunners must have had a dog. He was history, too. The back porch door was open 2 inches, and he remembered it. It was never fully closed. The door always was a bad fit, but now it wouldn't open either.
Thank you. Now, despite the character's affection for Oak Pine, it seems to be a place some of the young people want to escape, while some of the more wizened characters like Jimmy and Mason come back so they can recharge, but they also wrestle with their demons there. How do the characters who come home struggle with age and mortality differently from the ones who never really left?
Sometimes after you've been away from a place and you go back, and we sort of all have that chance at some point, there's that time in between that helps create a sharp marker. As I said, so many of the places I've gone back to change. Everybody remarks upon returning to their home or their hometown that it seems smaller sometimes. And there's also all those things that you remembered but had forgotten, especially the nature of the light and the magnitude of the sky. So it's a very powerful thing for a human being. We're such tender instruments, and I think a lot of things print on us hard, and I was working in this book on that.
I mean, the story might have been enough to talk about the four buddies reuniting, but the characters also frequently interact with Craig Ralston's son Larry, the high school football star who can't wait to go to college out of state, and his young girlfriend Wendy. Why did you choose to weave them into the older gentleman's experiences?
Well, I didn't mean to. I mean, I started, and then all of a sudden there was Larry. And as soon as someone enters your book, you've got to look at that person. He wasn't in your plan, and he's going to mess it up a little bit. But he's going to mess it up in the best way, complicate it, and layer it. And so you look at that character, and you say, okay, you want in? Get in. Come on. And so then you've got to find out who they are. And so it's this... A book unfolds in a way. I mean, my work has always, most of my, all the stories I've written and so on, all surprised me in these ways. And so I was pleased about the other generation. And I don't think that it's easy or nifty to sum up what a book is about, but I like the interplay of young and old. My father, near the end of his life on one of our road trips, said to me, he was telling stories about, he grew up in South Dakota, and he said, Ron, there's part of us that's always 17. And so I think you tap into that. And so I like the interplay between the generations.
Your book celebrates writers. Jimmy Brand moved to New York and became a writer, and when taken ill, comes back to Oak Pine to convalesce. And he also guides a young high school student, Wendy, on her own writing aspirations. How much do you identify with these characters?
Well, you have to be very careful writing writers. You'd never do it, really. If you're going to have an artist in a book, it would be so much better to have him be a painter or someone who draws, because then you've got all that good stuff, the notepad and the pencils and the paint. But you write a writer very carefully, and in a way I kind of understated it. In his work with Wendy, as he talks about writing, the little bit that he gets to, I wrote that very carefully. I've been a teacher for many, many years, and by now, of course, I've said every possible thing to the writers in my charge. So I tried to be spare with him. I tried to be real with him. And, of course, he's at a point in his life looking back about what he has done, and he's sort of measuring his achievement. And he still is another character. That's not me, except in the fact that all of your characters are a little bit of you.
Ron, thank you so much for talking with me about your book.
Of course. I appreciate it.
Ron Carlson is the author of Signals and Five Skies. His new book, Return to Oak Pine, is a novel set in the fictional town of Oak Pine, Wyoming.
When we come back, we'll hear from a burlesque performer about her career on the stage. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. This summer, StoryCorps set up a booth in Cheyenne to record Wyomingites interviewing one another and sharing their stories. Today, we'll hear from a burlesque performer. Her stage name is Stella Fox, and she talks with her fiancé, Jonathan Green, about her burlesque career.
Burlesque traditionally is the art of mocking. It's the art of mocking sexuality, making fun of social norms, and just kind of being playful. It's an art form where you go up on stage and you strip, you take your clothes off. Yes, that is part of it, but it's a kind of theatrical performance. You make your costumes, you dance, you're playful, you're sexy sometimes, you're silly sometimes.
How did you get into burlesque?
I got into burlesque probably about 4 years ago. I started taking classes when I was living in a different city, where it's intro to burlesque, where you learn how to strut, how to walk in heels, how to shake your butt, you know, do different things. And for me, it was really a way to push myself out of my comfort zone. I really decided to do it because it scared me. So I took the first class and got completely addicted to it and have been a part of the community ever since.
Tell me more about the community.
To me, the community is the biggest part of burlesque. And the first class I took, there was an 18-year-old girl in it, and there was a 50-year-old woman in the class. There was a mother and daughter taking it together. There was even a man who's straight and likes cross-dress. So for me, it was really amazing to meet all these different people coming from so many different backgrounds.
What would you say is the most difficult part of it?
Of burlesque?
Mm-hmm.
Is keeping my secret identity. I have to very much keep it separate from the rest of my life. Number one, for work, that's the biggest issue, is worrying about your employer finding out and not knowing how they'd react to it. It's something that I love, but it's something I don't want to lose my livelihood over. And then also just knowing how people are going to react. It makes some people very uncomfortable. And then some people are surprisingly laid back and cool about it. There's definitely people in my family that don't know about it. Not because I'm hiding it, but because it's something that never seems to come up. And I don't really want to show up at Christmas and say, hey, I take my top off. It's a secret life that I don't get to openly talk about.
Is it worth it?
Totally. Sometimes I wonder when I'm mostly loading up my car and I've got my hair in curls and 3 pounds of glitter on my face and I haven't eaten in 4 hours and I'm driving through a, you know, hailstorm to get to one of my performances. But somehow those 2 or 3 minutes on stage make it all worth it. I've done acts dressed up like the creature from the Black Lagoon. I've done a lumberjack act where I pretend to cut my clothes off with a fake chainsaw. I've done a U.S. tourist act where I walk around in a fanny pack and a sun visor and act like a big dork. So I like the idea of coming out on stage and not looking sexy and challenging the audience a little bit. You know, like if I came out in a full sequin gown and my hair done and my makeup done, I'm obviously looking nice. That's not a challenge for the audience to find that attractive. So I like playing with them a little bit, coming out just really not looking good, wearing granny panties and the whole nine yards. So yeah, so the character comes out and she's got a suitcase and she's dancing around. And as she strips, like any good traveler would, she makes sure to fold up her clothes very carefully and place them back into her suitcase. So at the end, I walk away completely with my granny panties and my pasties that look like travel stickers and my suitcase full of my packed clothes.
I go to many of your shows. How do you feel about me being there watching a bunch of different women get naked and occasionally men as well?
I feel fine with it. I think that it shows my comfort with our relationship. I don't fear that you're going to see some other dancer and leave me backstage somewhere. I really love the fact that you're comfortable going and watching other women and other men perform. It's just a sign of your comfort sexually, and I think it's very, very attractive, actually.
What's the most important thing Stella has taught you?
To love the body that I have. I was never an overly insecure person, but I think like any woman or man will tell you there's parts of anybody's body that they're not super excited about. But going up on stage and just standing there and exposing yourself and feeling glamorous and hearing other people agree with you that you look pretty good at that exact moment, or even that they just appreciate your confidence, has made me a lot more comfortable with my body, a lot less judgmental of myself.
I cherish all of my time with you.
Aw, shucks.
That was Stella Fox talking about her career as a burlesque performer. Stella Fox is her stage name. She spoke with her fiancé, Jonathan Green. The piece was produced by Willow Belden with interviews recorded at StoryCorps. StoryCorps is a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.